On behalf of Praxis, Manavi, and the Office on Violence Against Women, I welcome all of you to the fourth keynote address of the Advocacy Learning Center. I'm Shomita. I'm a representative of Manavi, but also I work with Praxis quite intimately. On this call, we have participants from Class A and Class B. I haven't met many of you. I think Class B I've met in March, most of you at least. And I know that all of you have met today's keynote speaker. Yeah, and even though we can't see each other, we are today virtually linked by technology. And let me summarize what's happening today. Most of you have probably been on a keynote address before. But the role of the keynote address in the Advocacy Learning Center curriculum is to inspire our thinking and analysis, and this is the way we can challenge our work. I believe that the keynote address, the topics that the speakers bring in, can really sharpen and improve our work and make us more sensitive to the needs of the women we work with. It takes us beyond our current understanding of violence against women. And today we are in for a treat. Our speaker is someone I think who needs no introduction, so I won't spend too much time. Ellen Pence is with us. And Ellen is the executive director, as you all know, of Praxis International and also the founding, one of the founding mothers of Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. Her work has been applauded and acclaimed everywhere, so I don't need to go into that. You'd all know about the CCR, you know about the different kinds of issues and programs and accountability audits she works on. But to me, more than anything else, she is an advocate for women's rights and specifically for battered women's rights. And I'm so very fortunate and privileged to present to you Ellen Pence. Ellen, you want to take it over?
Well, thank you, Shomita. Thank you very much. I got that on tape, I think, Shomita, the next time you're yelling at me for saying something stupid. So, okay, welcome, everyone, and it's nice to be all together again, and even though we can't see each other, at Praxis here, and I think at the Manavi office, too, we have all your pictures sitting in front of us, so when you talk later, we've got a little snapshot of every one of you in front of us. And I just want to say for all of those of you in Class B, those of you who went to the talent show Wednesday night in Class B, you know that Kimber and I won with our Italian opera, but apparently the belly dancers have filed a complaint, and they want a recount so that when we meet in September, we're going to have to kind of settle this very divisive, what's becoming a divisive explosive conflict, because the belly dancers are claiming that they were robbed of the rightful vote to be the number one. So we may have to show that belly dance again at the September Institute. So I think that might get more of you there, too. So I want to start by saying why I chose the topic for today's talk, and that is because a lot of times when I'm in a situation like a lot of times when I would do men's groups or women's groups, or I'd be at the police department, or I'd be at some legislative hearing, and somebody would put something out like, well, you know that a lot of these women are mentally ill, and there is a lot of harassment of men and a lot of, you know, violence towards men, or they come up with something, and I'd think, okay, that's true. It's not that women never shoot at men or that they never beat at men too, so what has that got to do with our analysis? And so you get in a situation, I remember some of these guys in the group saying things to me, and I'd think, now what am I supposed to say right here? What am I supposed to think right here? And I'd always, there's a couple fallback lines I always had. There's a couple people or books that I've read or people who have influenced me where I've always said, okay, what would so-and-so say? And then that always helped me. And so this talk that I'm giving actually comes from a woman named Andrea Dworkin, who many of you probably know. She died a few years back, but she was one of these people who just was unrelenting in her work about pornography and the ways that pornography directly leads to violence against women. And the first time I heard a talk, which is in the 1980s, I went home and I wrote this talk that I'm going to give you now. And since then, I've, you know, kind of, you know, fiddled around with it a lot because my understanding of what she was saying and my experiences have kind of deepened my understanding of this. But I want to say that it's rooted very much in her work and also in the work of a person who I've read everything he's ever written, Paulo Freire, who's a Brazilian educator who wrote a lot about the relationship of dominating groups to those who are dominated. And he was an educator, and he did education with poor people and disenfranchised people who were in oppressed groups, mostly in Latin America, a lot of work with peasants there and groups that had been totally disenfranchised, and how to do literacy training so that people could engage in more democracy for them and more freedom, economic freedom for themselves. So these two, this talk I'm going to give right now is really a combination of Andrea Dworkin and Paulo Freire, two very, very different people. And I just want to start by saying that when you do this work on ending violence against women, you know, we're always faced with an individual woman who comes before us, and usually she was abused, you know, violated by a small group of men or an individual man. And so the look of what we're doing has a very individual look. Well, look, this woman was abused by this man. But what we have, the first thing we always have to think about when we want to step back and we want to get any clarity is to understand that the violence that happened to this woman that day that's in your office right now or in your group or you're at the hospital with her, that violence has historic roots. It didn't start 10 years ago. It didn't start 50 years ago. It wasn't started because of Twitter or Facebook. It's rooted in the ongoing development of relationships between the dominating and the dominated social groups in a society. And these forms of domination are centuries in the making. So it's true that Twitter and Facebook might create new avenues of stalking or harassing or abusing women, but it's merely a new method of carrying out a relationship of domination that preceded this technology. So the first thing we always have to think of is this is historical. And it's shaped up over many, many years, and to undo it, it takes action on historic levels where we are over a long period of time chipping away at the very foundations of this violence. And the way we do our work with that individual woman will only change the numbers of women coming into those emergency rooms and those shelters and those groups if we do our work in a way that really goes after the very foundations of what creates this violence against women. And so we have to recognize always that whenever an individual person uses violence against, you know, let's say a man is using violence against a woman, it looks individual, but it's always embedded in social support. And there are many institutions and many social structures and many cultural practices that are controlled by the dominant group that are in place every day that feed this violence. And so again, every individual woman we work with, we have to work with her in a way that recognizes that this is a social matter. This is not just about her and him. This is about her as a part of a group that's vulnerable to this violence and him as a part of a group that carries out this form of violence. And third, that while this is carried out by individuals such as a battering husband or abusive mother, small groups of people, fraternity members carry this out, it's never committed out of a social context that produces that individual. So that individual abuser, that rapist, that mother who batters her child, all of those people who are in relationships of dominance and use this dominating relationship, use violence within this dominating relationship, they are produced by the society in which they came up. And so they don't individually choose this. And this notion that so-and-so chose to be violent, there's an element of that that's true, but there's another element of that that is naive to think that people, oh, you know, I can hardly wait to grow up so I can be a batterer. It's not like a life path choice that very many people make. It's something that they're moved into. And so, yes, they chose that night to do what they did, But did they choose to be this way, to have these attitudes towards women, to hold this hostility, to act with such disdain, to be so brutal? No. And so we need to think all the time that these people are being produced, and the way that we intervene has to intervene in a way that produces less of that kind of hostility towards women. So today I want to talk about violence against women is linked to four foundational pillars. And first I'm going to say something about all four of those pillars. Then I'll go through each one individually, and we'll open it up after a little while and talk about what this means to you in terms of your advocacy or insights or thoughts that you might have about any of these pillars. So while you're working with an individual woman today, we always have to think, this individual woman and this individual man, the way I work with them, I have to weaken those pillars if I want to stop this violence. And the first pillar is the use of every major social institution, whether it's religion, psychology, the law, educational systems, or economic system, to somehow reinforce the notion that the dominant group is naturally better than the dominated group. In our case, that men are superior to women. But this is also true with whites being, you know, the institutions and the cultural practices of a society reinforcing this notion of white supremacy, of hierarchical relationships, and with people are at the top of these hierarchical relationships because they're better than and naturally better than the dominated group. So whether it's men over women or able-bodied over disabled or Europeans over indigenous people, rich over poor, whatever that is, the dominant group is seen as better than, and the institutions support that. The third pillar is the use of the second pillar is the use of social institutions and cultural practices to make the dominant group into the other, to objectify them, to dehumanize them, and to create a group that is that you are able to then violate. And so to make them into savages, to make them into whores, to make them into something, not someone, but something that can be then abused. And because of who they are, their abuse is visited upon them, not because of who the abuser is, but because of who the abused is. The third pillar is the use of institutions and social structures and cultural practices to force the dominated group to submit to this dominance, to submit to their inferior status, to accept it, and to submit to the control of the dominant group. And finally, the last pillar that holds violence together, when you have a society in which one group uses a lot of violence against another group, the fourth pillar is the ability of that dominating group to use violence with impunity. The fewer social and family and religious and economic and legal and cultural sanctions there are for this violence, the more likely it is to occur. So, and likewise, you know, the more rewards there are for nonviolence, the less likely it is to occur. So, that fourth pillar is one that, of course, most of us have been working towards. The whole Violence Against Women Act, a major, major piece of the Violence Against Women Act, and we're all grantees because of that act, is to increase the use of the legal system to create sanctions for violence against women, to make the legal system a more effective tool of deterrence. And this fourth pillar is all about what are the social sanctions to this violence? Not necessarily always legal. Social sanctions include how do families sanction it, how do churches sanction it, how do any of our institutions sanction it. But in some ways, most of us are engaged in some way of trying to create sanctions against this violence. And so let's go into the first one, which then is the natural superiority of the dominant group. And you know, the dominant group always represents the norm, and then the dominated group becomes, by default, the other. This is the norm, and this is the other. And the dominant group represents the norm. As an advocate, we see this all the time, but it's not as blatant as it probably was 100 years ago, where men just had all these rights over women. If they wanted to get divorced, they could leave women, and if they wanted their kids, they could take them, and they had land rights, and the women didn't have any land rights. It was just all nice and clean and clear, and nobody questioned it. But over time, that's been questioned, and so now it's not, people aren't so, you know, out there blatantly with some of this stuff. So sometimes it looks like these institutions are now gender neutral, and there's been a lot of work that's made them less supportive in some ways of male dominance, but these institutions still belong to they belong in every way, and they represent the thinking and the logic and the assumptions and the values of the dominating group. And so I'm going to give you three little examples of just things that, as an advocate, that I've come across in the last year of working, that represent kind of the way this hierarchy works in very what you'd call masked ways, things that just don't jump out at you, but when you're in the middle of doing, you think something's wrong here, this isn't right. And oftentimes when you get that feeling in your stomach, how could somebody write that report to the court, or how could this be something that someone's recommending, and you just think, this is so unfair, this doesn't fit, then usually what it is, it's something, it's not somebody just saying, oh, she's a woman, he's a man, I'm going to give custody of the kids to him. It's more that it's being taken up by an institution in ways that reflect the values and the interests of men over women. So I'll give you one example. I'm working on this project recently where we're reading a whole bunch of custody evaluations. And these get written when a man and a woman go to court and they can't make an agreement on who's going to have legal custody of the kids or physical custody of the kids or what kind of visitation the non-custodial parent will have. And so the order, oftentimes one person will claim, well, she's mentally ill, she's bipolar, she's this, she's that, he's this. And so the judge will say, okay, I'm going to order psychological evaluations. And usually the judge orders psychological evaluations of both parties. So I'm reading all these case files where you have his psychological evaluation and hers. And the one thing about all the case files I have is there's a substantial history of domestic violence in all of them. And so when I'm reading the case files, I'm reading ones where, okay, the psychologist will say something like this. This is a little quote from one of them. This is a woman who is dependent. She's often seeking the approval of others. She has an extreme need to feel connected. She has a sense of being fulfilled only in relationship to someone else. She has not individuated into a mature adult. And these kinds of things are said in these custody evaluations over and over and over again. Now, if you read that, you're saying, here's a woman who's a stay-at-home mother. She has a need to feel connected. Now, I don't exactly know why that doesn't mean she's a mature adult, but what is she being compared to? The tests that she's being asked to take, the psychological exams, the tests by the psychologist, the psychologist's interpretation of her answers are all comparing her to the independent, autonomous male figure that is supposed to be the ideal person in our society, the one who doesn't need someone, the one who stands alone, who can stand independent of others. And so when she has a deep need to feel connected, that makes her the other, and she'll test out that way psychologically. And in almost every one of these cases that we looked at, the men scored better on these psychological exams than the women did. Now, the only thing I know about their histories from looking at these is he's battering her. He's using a lot of violence against her, and she's the subject of this violence. And so the fact that he's scoring, the batterer is scoring higher than the woman who's being battered on the psychological test, it's not just because she's unstable and scoring lower, but it's because the tests are designed to privilege who he is and what he is and the values he holds and the viewpoints he holds and the way that he goes about being in the world and devaluing the way that she goes about being in the world. And so this is an example of the hierarchy in action, where you couldn't see it that way. It wouldn't look like that. But when you get into there and you read the psych exam, you say, how could they say this? How could they recommend custody to him? And in many of these cases, they recommend custody to him because he scores higher in these tests. So the psychological, I'll give you another example, and then later I'll come back to what's messed up about some of this. The second example that I came across fairly recently is that I was doing a study in Fresno, California, and we were observing social workers conducting bonding studies with African-American women. And this woman, the one of the women that we're observing, that the daughter had been put in care because her brother had sexually abused the child. And so the bonding, the person who's doing the bonding study is supposed to do three things. They're supposed to watch this woman physically care for her child, and like she does her hair, is the way that, you know, she's doing her hair, and they give her this task to do her daughter's hair. And then next, she's supposed to engage in constructive play with her daughter. And the third is that she's supposed to communicate with her daughter about school. And then the observer is supposed to watch to see if the mother did this way in a way that indicates that she's bonded to her child. And, of course, these whole ways of being bonded and what bonded means and why these things get to be examples of a mother being bonded with her child are all, again, steeped in some kind of assumption and theory by the system of what this would look like. This is not going to be the same thing that a man goes through to see if he's bonded with his child. And the tests, not only are the tests going to be slightly different, but the interpretation of the tests are going to be very different, because the expectations of a man to do his daughter's hair, or to of a man to, you know, talk about her school with her, are quite different than the expectations of the mother figure. So this, it, again, in these tests, the women show as not bonding with their children very well. Oftentimes, the women are not bonded with their children in relationship to these tests. Now, one of these tests was an interesting one where she shows, the woman tests out as not being bonded with her child, but at the same time, the child is calling her mother every night, and her mother is not supposed to have contact with the child. So she uses her sister's cell phone. So it looks like the kid is actually calling her aunt. So if the social worker checks in on it, she just sees that she's talking to her aunt every night. But these two are talking for an hour, hour and a half every night. And they're talking about everything under the sun. But when they took their bonding study, they showed as not being bonded. So instead of seeing this daughter calling her mom every night and wanting to talk to her as an example of bonding, it was shown as an example of her refusing to cooperate with the child welfare system. And the child got taken away from her aunt's house and put in a foster care home of a stranger. So this is an example of, again, the way the system works in relationship to women is that it keeps women in a functionary role that when they in any way don't conform what is seen as a traditional functionary role of women, then they're tested out, or they're seen as being the other, being not the good woman, not the good mother, not the good wife, etc. And this all contributes to not only the objectification of women, which is the next one we're going to talk about, but it contributes to this constant reinforcement of men's superiority over women, because men are testing out more positively in all these things. The third thing I want to bring up is a rape trial that we went through in Minnesota last year that was just, we went through. I mean, I felt like the whole state went through this rape trial, but this woman went through the rape trial. And she was a student at a university. She'd gotten raped by this guy, and his friends were watching and taping this rape. And in this tape, which was actually shown on TV, parts of this tape were actually shown on TV, you can't tell for sure if he's penetrating her, so he gets off on this charge of first-degree sexual assault because you can't prove penetration. Now, women do not, if we are talking about our experience of being raped, we don't sit around and talk about whether or not we were penetrated. We talk about whether or not we were raped. And when we're talking about whether or not we were raped, we're talking about whether or not we were forced against our wills to engage in, or for him to force us and do things to our bodies that we didn't want. And so this notion of a certain kind of penetration and then what they call digital penetration, all these kind of things, separates out in an unnatural way our bodies from our experiences. And so for women, and for men too, we have two experiences of life. We have the material, the bodily experience of life, and then we have the symbolic experience of things. So everything to us is symbolism. you know, I mean, the meaning that we place on things that happen are very, very symbolic. And so when you divorce these things from each other and you just look at the material body, that is a whole element that supports men's superiority of women. Because in things like rape trials, in things like having our children taken away from us, as part of a custody case or part of a child protection case, in things like battering cases, whether or not we were stalked or whether or not we were harassed is partly about the material thing of what happened and partly about the symbolic thing of what is making us afraid of this person, what we are experiencing as a violation of our space, a violation of our minds, of our, you know, psychological selves. And so it's kind of like, let's say you're getting on a plane, all right, and you're heading off to Budapest. And while you're in this plane and going to Budapest, a Cardassian agent accuses you of espionage for the U.S., and you're flown to Cardassia. And then you're given all sorts of tests to see if you were, in fact, a spy. Now, this guy's thinking you're a spy. He brings you to Cardassia. Now, if, by the way, don't worry if you don't know where Cardassia is. I got it from Star Trek. There is no country called Cardassia. But there are Cardassians, and they live in, you know, someplace in the Star Trek world, you know. But anyways, you're caught up now, and you're off to Cardassia. And the first test they give you is, do you know how to greet people at a wine party? And the test requires that if you're going to pass it, someone's going to come up, and you're supposed to kiss them on the cheek, if they're of the opposite sex, first on the right cheek, and then two kisses on the left cheek. And the whole time, you shake their hands with yours. And if you greet that way, then you pass that part of the test. If you greet someone of the same sex, you're supposed to hold both of their hands in your hand, and you're supposed to nod twice while you're shaking. Now, you're going to probably fail that test because you have no idea how to greet someone properly at a Cardassian wine party, right? You fail that test because you don't know the rules. But there's two problems with this kind of testing that I talked about earlier in this Cardassian test. And that is, the first one is that oftentimes the test has nothing to do with the question, are you a spy? And secondly, it doesn't measure what it says it's going to measure. And remember that all of these institutions that create tests or any kind of things that we have to pass, legal, you know, all these kind of legal tests and all these kind of psychological tests and these bonding tests and all these things that we're subjected to when we get brought into these institutions, they are basing all of this on the norm, which is typically from the interests of the prevailing ways of thinking, and those are embedded in the hierarchies in our society, which puts men at those top positions and women at the bottom. So they're not reflecting women's experiences, women's ways of thinking, women's ways of processing. And so in the same way, these psychological studies, they don't tell the court if you'd be a good parent for your child, and it doesn't measure your mental health status very accurately. The bonding study doesn't help the court decide if you're safe to be with your child, and it really doesn't tell you if a woman is bonded to her child. The rape trial, it has nothing to do with how women experience rape, how we talk about it, how we recover from it, the devastating effects, what would we consider a just outcome. So these kinds of institutional experiences that we're brought into where our relationships with our abusers are being managed by these institutions are really divorced from women's experience. And this is part of the way that the natural superiority of, you know, the hierarchy of men's dominance over women is constantly reinforced in religious institutions, in legal institutions, in the psy professions, in the school system. You could take, this group on the phone right now could think of a million examples of institutions that you've worked in where the things I'm talking about now have come about. And so as advocates, when women are brought into these kinds of institutions and we think there's something wrong, they're sexist, that's all we can say, they're sexist, they're male-dominated. But what do we mean by that? It always comes down to these kinds of practices. And it's the institution, the worker doesn't sit there and blatantly say, she's a woman, he's a man, he gets the kids. They're using these tools and they're processing cases, and they're organized into this work in a way that's going to privilege men's experience and privilege men's claims to the entitlements of certain things in our society. So if you look around now, we can say it's the year 2010. Have we eliminated the key social supports for the ideal of male superiority? And the answer is no. You know, every institution still measures its interventions in our lives based on the concepts and the theories and the assumptions that negate our experiences. And so this is a cornerstone of what keeps not only men in those hierarchical positions, but promotes the violence against us that they then use. Most women who watch that tape, you know, this tape of this woman getting raped, and you imagine that that happened to you, you would consider this is rape. But the legal system in this case required that the prostitution showed penetration. And why? Who is penetration a requirement for? Under what laws of nature does it say we don't experience rape unless we're penetrated? And humans don't simply, we don't live just in a body. You know, as I said, we have this material level that we're experiencing things, but then we have this symbolic level that we're experiencing things. And when you watch this tape and you see this woman laying down on this bed that she was thrown onto by this young man, she barely knew him, he's straddling her, and he's yelling in this shrill voice, he's mimicking a cowhand that's riding a bull, and her eyes are rolling back, tears are streaming down her cheek, and she was being raped. And but not measured by that institution. And these are the things that we have to be aware of when we're in working with a woman as an advocate and we're in an institution and something doesn't feel right. It feels like this is biased. There's something wrong with this. This is sexist. These are the words we have for it. But we have to see into what is going on, and we have to be able to see that this notion of not only male superiority, but this notion later of objectifying women, forcing submission, and allowing violence with impunity, all these things are built into every major institution that we connect with. So we live in a deeply gendered world where our bodies, you know, are still the main thing that defines our function, whether it's in the home, whether it's the workplace, the economy. It defines our function in our temples and our churches, our mosques, our synagogues, our sweat lodges. Who we are and what we are defined by this body that we live in. And now you've probably picked up, for those of you, you know, that we've been at these institutes together, that I dress a little bit on the androgynous side. I don't dress totally like a man, but I'm not very girly either. So now that, you know, I'm hairless and breastless and I'm walking around with these clothes on, I'm every day mistaken for a man, every single day. And so I always say to someone, well, I'm a woman. And then people just profusely apologize to me. I say, that's okay, that's okay. I'm not insulted. You know, I'm not putting off a lot of girl vibes here, you know, and there's nothing that really looks very girly on me. And so I'm not insulted, but still they apologize again. And what is the insult to me to mistake my gender? But you can go onto any playground at any school in this country, and you can see if you really want to insult someone, that's what you go for, is their gender, and so their gender and their race. And so you, you know, especially boys, you know, it's that you're a sissy, you're a girl, go get your skirt on, hike up your skirt, all those kinds of things that you say, you know, go home and cry to your mommy. And so this whole way of insulting from a very, very young age, kids learn to insult other kids, by, especially boys, by calling them girls. And then also with that, by calling them a girl, calling them a fag or calling them gay or calling them queer, all those things that go with that notion that he's a girl. And so the most basic presumption of our upbringing is that boys are more important, they're better, they're more developed than girls, and it's the first pillar that that ultimately comes to support their violence against girls. Because this position then in the world of being on the top of this hierarchy or this triangle of where you're better than, it's a space that men occupy, and that space gets passed down from generation to generation. And the new generation that takes it, they become heirs to these entitlements. They don't necessarily connect with the source of this power. They don't see that it comes at the expense of the dominated. In fact, quite the opposite. Most dominating groups come to see the dominated as violent, as savage, as uncivilized, again, as whores. They develop a consciousness of possession where they belong at the top and the people at the bottom are at the bottom because they're not like them. And they're at the bottom because they're other. And this consciousness feeds, it sustains, it maintains not only a sense of entitlement but a sense of the ability to use violence, and that violence is sometimes something that needs to be had. It also creates a consciousness of possession, where if you can possess something, you can have it, you can do with it what you will. And so people believe that if I've got a lot of money, if I'm making 200 grand a year and I can go out and buy this boat with a 75 horsepower motor, I can go on any lake I want and run around in that boat and pollute that water because I can afford it, because I can pay for it. And so this notion of possession and ownership coming together and entitlement all at one leaves people who are the dominator with a consciousness of, if I can possess it, then I can control it. So that we have a situation now where we think we can control the weather, we can control the earth, we can control everything. We have spent most of the earth's resources in the last 40 years because we have such power of domination over the earth now, such power to take things out of the earth, to mine things, to take oil out of the earth, all those kind of things. Now that we have the power of possession, with it comes a consciousness that we're entitled to all those things, that that doesn't belong to generations that come after us. It belongs to us now. And so remember, there's always a consciousness that accompanies these hierarchical relationships. And so they're not the consciousness of the individual. It's not something that this guy individually came to. It's something that he inherits. It's something that he feels entitled to. And it's a way of thinking that's inherent in his position in that triangle or in that hierarchy, and then so is the consciousness of the person at the bottom. And I'll talk about that a little bit later when we talk about objectification and submission. And so I just want you, before we take a break here, I want you to get out a pen and a paper, and I just want you to put a great big old triangle on that paper. And you're going to use this, you know, to jot down any kind of notions about the hierarchy. But the triangle is, we have to recognize this, that it's not necessarily a natural shape. It's a man-made. It defines the relationships between people in most societies. Yet many societies, especially indigenous ones, have for centuries had either a flattened hierarchy or a circle, really, that showed the relationships between people in their societies. So we know that the triangle is a cultural configuration. It's not a natural one. And if it's cultural, meaning that people made it, humans made it, then it can be changed because people can unmake it. They can have a different cultural configuration, a different way of displaying and organizing relationships between us. And so as long as that triangle exists, it has to be, because it's unnatural for people to live that way, for people to live in a suppressed condition, and for people also to live separated from others that really are like them, then it has to be constantly reinforced by these institutions. And the extent to which we can keep institutions from reinforcing it is the extent to which we weaken it and ultimately end it. So across the bottom of your paper now, you got your triangle. I want you to write these words and see if you recognize these words. Connect, understand, analyze, strategize, implement, and reflect. Those are the six activities of advocates. And when we're advocating for women who are the objects of this violence, and we're advocating to disenfranchise men's ability to use it, and at the same time, in a way that humanizes both us as victims and humanizes the person using this violence, then these are the activities that we're doing. We're connecting, understanding, analyzing. And how does this, the existence of these hierarchical relationships and this notion that they're natural and the way they're embedded in all our institutions, how does that impact us as advocates? And how does it shape up how it is that we go about our business? So I think we'll just stop here and do a quick little check-in with people, see how you're doing. And if you want to chime in with any insights that you have about this or ways that this influences your advocacy, go ahead and say something. We'll see. How are we going to do this now, Shamita?
Ellen, I thought that this would be also a good time to ask people, maybe for 5 or 6 minutes, if they have any questions.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm doing now, right?
Okay, great. So let's do that.
I'll just give you directions to ask a question. Push *1 on your keypad, and Stephanie will get you in the question queue. Or feel free to email me at any time, and I'll ask the question or make the comment or respond for you, Beth@praxisinternational.org. So Stephanie, just checking it, did anybody push the *1 button for us? We have no questions in the question queue.
Well, somebody asked a question. Somebody asked a question. Otherwise, I think what they all fell sound asleep.
I do have something that I wanted to ask you, and I probably have been asking you for a long time. One of the, you're talking about dominance and the naturalization of that dominance in society. But one of the things that we hear, and I'm an immigrant from outside of this country, but I've lived here long enough, that certainly in certain societies, there have been a lot of changes. There's a lot of attention being paid to women's rights and thinking about women's rights. And in countries, almost in every country in the world, there's some kind of a women's rights-based movement that is going on. But one of the things that we see here is that because women are given, prominence, because there are these, institutional acknowledgement for women's problems and issues and concerns, or some amount at least, that there is always this feeling that, we are not in that kind of a position. We are not, this is not our mother's movement, so to speak. This is a different society it happens to Afghanistani women, it happens to Bangladeshi women, or it happens to women in Nigeria, that they are in such bad shape. However, we are in a good shape, and therefore we have passed that stage. We have passed the stage of thinking about an unadulterated dominance in society. And so therefore, what we can really think of, or what we have graduated to, is the individual kind of violence and dominance. And if we can, those are the anomalies of certain men. Maybe they are badly brought up, maybe they're, XYZ is happening. So those are the bad apples. But the rest of it has been changed. Society has moved on. It may not be the same as it was when the first mothers talked about this.
Well, yeah, and I think that's not just in the United States. That's true, like in South Africa now, women are being told, well, you now have land rights and the law was changed and you've got equal rights, so you're in the same boat as men now. So it's happening everywhere where you have, people, you have these struggles between the people at the bottom of the triangle and people at the top, and when people at the bottom of the triangle start to articulate things, and then there's a dealing with those issues on some level, so that you maybe take the most harsh parts of those things away, like slavery. You eliminate slavery, but you don't eliminate the exploitation of labor. So you still have a form of economic exploitation, but you don't have it in the name of slavery anymore. But that doesn't mean that it's not devastating to people, that there's still not the same kind of depletion of people's souls under this kind of system of economic, of poverty, et cetera. But you've gotten rid of this one big thing. And so that's part of that whole struggle, is that as you start to get, any group that kind of starts to identify their issues and then articulates them to the powerful, they will take up some of those issues, but not enough to completely. That's the difference between, this kind of what people would think of as revolutionary, which means the whole thing changed and it became a different structure, or something where it just became less less blatant, and in some ways it blunted some of the sharpness of it all. I mean, even though women are not in equal positions to men anymore, we don't live in the same kind of harsh conditions that our great-grandmothers did. there has been this movement. Now, not always, I mean, not for every woman. For some women, their lives are, from birth, just, you know, horribly, horrible suffering. But that, across the board, women are in better shape than they were 100 years ago in this country. And the idea is that we're somehow moving forward, but many people always argue that this isn't always a constantly forward-moving thing. But for sure what you're saying is true, is that you get rid of the big symbols of oppression, but you keep the mainstay things. And that's why I'm saying that as advocates, we no longer can just see these blatant things where the men just got custody of the kids automatically because they were men. Now instead, if they fight for custody, they're more likely to get it than the women are. But it's because of these hidden ways that it's still, the institution still acts in the interest of and in the value system of men. And we have to be able to see that and create counters to that. Like, you know, for example, one of the things that we're trying to do is to just create, you know, create tools that the court has to use to determine where the kids go that don't operate so much from these, you know, psychological tests and all these kind of things that are keeping it all in the men's hands. And so this is kind of a, we had this lucky period there for a little while where they just assumed that because women were mothers, they should get the kids. And so there was this little brief period of time in history where women kind of had the big advantage around getting kids, and that got squashed, everything got squashed in that. But so I think that's across the board, though, Shamita, what you're saying is that these really sharp, visual, harsh kinds of ways of exploiting and dominating are muted, and they're hidden much more now than they used to be. And so women are being told, well, there now, see, it's all equal, so it's just an individual issue if you didn't make it.
Makes it much harder to fight it.
Yes, it's much harder to point to the problems.
Are there any questions, Stephanie? Hello? Beth?
Yes, at this time we don't have any questions in my email. And
hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi,
yes.
Stephanie.
Oh, hi. Okay. We do have a question in the queue, and that comes from OVW. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm very eager to hear your fallback lines that you mentioned. I was wondering if you were going to do that later, or if it's going to be mixed throughout.
Well, my first fallback one was this, you know, when I think about, my fallbacks are, you know, I always fall back to what would Martin Luther King think when when it's an issue around race. I always fall back to Paulo Freire, I fall back to Andrea Dworkin, these people who had frameworks that are really helpful to me. And the Dworkin-Freire framework is this one of the triangle, and always recognizing that you're never operating individual to individual, but you're always operating within this bigger triangle, so that if I'm sitting in a men's group and the guy will say, I'll tell you what, listen to what my wife does, okay? Mm-hmm. And then he'll start on this whole story, and the men will go, yeah, Ellen, what do you think of that, huh? And then I fall back to this thing, and if I see the triangle, the first thing I see, I hear Ferrari's words, which are, people at the top always feel victimized by people at the bottom. And they portray themselves as the victims of those that they are keeping down. And so then I look at a whole group of men who are feeling victimized, and my comeback is, let's talk about how we're feeling victimized right now. Mm-hmm. And so I get clarity. So instead of getting drawn into their kind of whining about, well, she does this and she does that. And I remember one man in my group saying, you know what my problem is? My wife's got a mind of her own. I said, oh, my God. You're kidding me. You know, that's terrible. How did you meet her? You know, so they really very easily get into feeling victimized. And then when they get into this role, I'm listening to all these little complaints about women, and I lose my ability to think, and then I can fall back to the triangle. And then my very favorite book, which is really old, is Pedagogy of the Oppressed, in which Ferrari does this brilliant analysis of the relationship of the person at the top of that triangle to the bottom, both a political and an economic analysis and a psychological analysis. And that to me is a major fallback, and that goes with Andrea Dworkin's notion of these four pillars. Those are hers. But Ferrari's got this whole analysis of the dominator-dominated relationships. And then my other one is always falling back on, you know, if I'm talking with women or talking to men or I'm talking to a cop, and I think about this in terms of race relationships instead of gender, would I buy whatever's being said to me right now? How would I understand it? So, for example, it always helped me when people would say that this is an anger management problem that men are having when they beat women. And I think, would Martin Luther King ever run a group, an anger management group for white racists, you know? Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. You know, and let's get our stress reduction going. And so those, to me, fallback positions for me are always ones that let me step out of the immediacy and the individualizing of the violence to this bigger historic social view of it. And these big thinkers like Mandela and Dworkin and bell hooks, and if you can read some of the people who are big thinkers that way, they really help you get out, and they give you frameworks. And they're extremely useful when you're in these kind of situations with people, with sheriffs or with, you know, prosecutors or whatever. You know, prosecutors always want to go for the prosecution, and so you get caught up in their argument about this victim isn't really giving you a good case, et cetera, et cetera. But then I fall back to, well, how did they ever win cases against these white supremacists in the South? They started to win cases against them, even with all white juries. How did they do it? And it was that the prosecutors took on the cases in a different way. And so, you know, whenever you kind of can get back, that's what I mean by fallback positions, where you see bigger pictures, and meaning you have to do some reading and you have to do some studying of some of these social movements that give you a better picture, because you get lost in that individual thing. You get all caught up in it.
And I also want to say, before we move on, I think we need to move on, that there's a lot being written within the women's movement and women's rights issues where the same kinds of research and literature is available around the world, and particularly in the global South. There's a lot of very similar to what you're talking about issues.
It is always on, because I stopped reading in 1978, so she's always bringing up these books from the 70s.
Well, okay.
But, you know, they're good. They're good. They're classics.
Yeah, classics. Ellen, I think we need to move on, because you still have a number of other issues to discuss.
So the next pillar, let's go on to the next pillar, which is the objectification of whenever you, if you look at the triangle again, people at the bottom of that triangle are made into, they don't exist as the other, they're made into the other. I always like this expression, the other, because they're other than people at the top. And the extent to which you can say that they're not like us, that you can dehumanize them, that you can objectify them, and the whole idea of objectification is to turn a human into an object, and once they have object status, you are free to do with them as you will, including using violence, including sexual abuse, all forms of taking your pleasure and having that pleasure with that person and not having to in any way relate to what it is actually doing to that person, the suffering that you're causing, because you're not causing suffering. You're dealing with another. You're dealing with something that's not human like you. And so the most basic fact is that people are far less likely to commit acts of violence against those that they see as peers, people who are like them, who occupy the same group, or those who are superior to them, than they are if the person is less than them, or if the person is an inferior group to them. So if you look at all the extreme violence that we see, the genocide, the ethnic cleansing, enslavement of people, those group acts of violence against another group are always a long time in the making of vilifying and dehumanizing the group that is to be dominated and that is to be gotten rid of. And so, you know, whether it's something like the Holocaust or what happened in Rwanda or what happened in Cambodia, those kinds of extreme violence that happened to people by one group of people against another group of people, the people who are doing the violence do not think of the people that they're violating as like them. And so this is a, I can't ever remember when I did a men's group of talking with a man who felt that the woman that he was beating wasn't somehow deserving of that and wasn't somehow to blame. I very rarely saw a man who said she had nothing to do with it, this was all about me, because in his head he needed to turn her into that. And it's the same with when you deal with, I did a group for many years of mothers who had abused their children. And this is when I was actually quite young, way too young to be doing a group like this. But almost every mother picked out one of her children to be more brutal to them. And she might have hit all of her kids, but it was always one kid almost that she was most violent towards and who suffered the most injuries. And those kids she always defined as being a problem since birth, colicky, hard to deal with, a picky eater, you know, all these things that she built up in her head that made this kid different than her other kids. And that's the child that she, you know, and some of the women had these notions of their kids being possessed by Satan. I mean, this is Satan's message to me, and that the child was not, you know, they just were not like the other kids. And so this idea of vilifying and putting the person out, individual men don't do that with individual women. It's done on a social level through the use of pornography, through the media, you know, so that many times you'll see that women in groups, you know, women who are victims of rape or women who are victims of battering, stalking, that if they had communications with their rapist or the person who's battering them or stalking them, they oftentimes, if women in the groups would say, that's what he said to me too, that's what he said to me, almost like somebody put out a book of what these guys are supposed to say to women. Now, how is it that they share some of the same fantasies, that they want to do the same things to humiliate or degrade women, that they tell women the same kind of things? You know, I'll make you so ugly, no other man will have you. I bought and paid for you. All those kind of things that they're saying. I've been in Australia. I did groups when I was in Australia. Every place I go, I always end up doing a men's group. I've done a men's group in Ireland, in England, in Australia, in New Zealand, in different parts of the United States. And I tell you, except for the accents, these guys are all saying the same thing. And so how is that possible? They didn't meet each other. They haven't been in each other's countries. And so the thing that we have to understand is that these are not the acts of individual people. They're the acts that individual people carry out within a context in which they're taught how to do it. And so if we want to get rid of this violence against women, we've got to keep working against these major ways of objectifying women, pornography being a major one, the use of the media to objectify women, the use of the psy professions to objectify women by, you know, all of these institutional sports, the use of faith communities. Now, the good thing is, for every institution that objectifies women, those same institutions, they carry the seeds of women's oppression and of violence against us, but they also carry the seeds of the other. So faith communities, almost every religion has a piece of that religion that also says that this isn't right to do to women. And within the media, there's a huge push within the media to equalize relationships between men and women and the way they're portrayed in the media. There's a push to do that in the law. So we can't always look, these institutions are a reflection of the contradictions in our own society. So we have to look at them as, yes, they are maintaining and supporting the violence, but at the same time, they're also the place where you're going to find that you can undo the violence. I mean, this is a very strange time that we're in, that the Department of Justice, for God's sakes, is putting millions and millions of dollars out for people to organize to change institutional support of violence against women. This is a period in history that we've never seen before, and that the Department of Justice has done this within an office called the Office on Violence Against Women. And in that office, Now, I'm not saying that some of you haven't had problems with the Office on Violence Against Women. Some of you are frustrated with rules or this and that. But that office has maintained a pretty strong commitment to the voice of advocacy, the forced involvement of us in everything. They don't give money out to people unless they include us and let us in the door. So we've had a period of time here where a major federal institution is putting out millions of dollars that we, as a group, are taking advantage of to change. And to actually, this isn't just to provide services, it's also to change the institutional support for this violence. So I don't want to do this all doom and gloom, because while we have all this objectification of women, and it's such a basic pillar of violence against us, the same people, the same methods that are used to do it are methods that we can use to undo it. Now, there's this other way of thinking that you can't use the master's tools to undo the master's house or whatever. I can't remember that saying. Do you remember that one, Shamita? I can't remember it exactly, but you can't use the what is it?
Yeah, you can't dismantle the master's house by using master's tools.
Yeah, I think why not use his? You know, they're there. That's my theory on that one. So he's probably got the best tools. Why not use them? So, you know, you can use those institutions. They're institutions that reflect what's going on in society. So to the degree to which we have agency, that we can act, that we can do things, we want to use those institutions to change this. And that's why, for those of you, I think some of you were at the Class A has been to the three-day institute, and for Class B that's coming to the three-day institute, that's all about how is all of this buried in these institutions and how do we organize, how do we do all those things, connect, understand, analyze, strategize within an institutional context. So just a second, I actually have some notes here. Let me look at them for a second.
Ellen, while you're
doing
that, I'm just going to remind people to push star one if you want to pop into the question queue and have any questions for me. To field for Ellen, you can also email me. And Stephanie, just a quick question check if we have anybody waiting.
At this time, there are no questions in the queue.
Great, but there's still a lot of time left. Star one if you do.
Okay, so people can jump in any time, and then Stephanie, let me know when I breathe in. Okay, so the same dynamic, you know, that's, the same dynamic that happens with the consciousness of a person who's dominating happens with the dominated. So a lot of people say, well, women are in denial. You know, we individualize the psychology of women who are victims of violence, whether it's rape or battering. But the psychology of people at the bottom of that triangle, it's not necessarily so much of an individualized psychological response. There is a consciousness of living at the bottom of that triangle, and part of that consciousness is one of acceptance. You know, you know, if every single institution that's influencing you in your life, and all of the major kind of cultural practices and those things are telling you that you're inferior, are telling you that good women, this doesn't happen to good women, it happens to not so good women, then of course when you get raped, when you get beaten, it's going to be about you. It's not that you have low self-esteem that's somehow a function of your personality. It's that you've been already pre-socialized, just like the men have been pre-socialized to move into their space of entitlement. So have women been pre-socialized to move into their space of being dominated. And it's very, very difficult for us to break out of. I always use this as an example, and I probably did it when you were at an institute of many, many times when I'm speaking at conferences, you know how they always have these big hotels, and then you have a big session in a room, and then they open up the back doors and everybody goes out. And a lot of times if I'm walking out talking with a man, as soon as we get to those big doors, he puts his hand on my back and aims me through the hole. And I think, well, I always say, thank you. I didn't see that hole there, you know. It's just like two doors wide open. It's probably about 14 feet wide. And I always think, I wonder what they're thinking when they do that I can't get through it. But it's this guiding thing. And every, you know, if you look at from the time we're very little, when we dance, the men guide. When we drive, they usually drive. When we go through a door, they push us through the door. All these kind of things of taking the lead and then being led. And that is the consciousness that comes with being at the bottom of the triangle is one that that people talk about, you know, this idea of, you know, internalizing the thoughts of the oppressor. You house the consciousness of the oppressor because your function and your role is to function for that person. And so you learn how to function well for that person. And so there's a whole socialization that we have. I know I told the story of being, as a kid, you know, wanting a gun really bad for Christmas, instead getting this doll. And I was so disappointed when I got this doll, but my sister came up and she's saying, feed it, Ellen, feed it. And she gives me this little bottle, and this was very advanced back in the 1950s when I was growing up, and you put this bottle in the baby's mouth, and then it peed all over me. And, you know, that was, my sister kept saying, isn't that neat? And I kept thinking, what is neat about this? Give me the gun, you know, any day. And so, you know, there's this kind of place that we're, and we all know about this socialization process. And for women who think they haven't been subjected to it or that they don't have this, it's a certain amount of naivete on one hand, but also it's not recognizing the degree to which it's really encompassed all of us. Just like most men feel entitled to a certain, you know, like, you know, a guy will get unemployed and he'll still not then pick up all the housework while she's off at work. You know, they'll do the bare minimum, but they don't all of a sudden say, okay, you're at work, I'll do this, because that's still in his mind seen mostly as women's work. And so these consciousnesses that we have within this triangle are not ones of our individual making, and that's why this taking a psychological approach to women that doesn't show the triangle and doesn't talk about the bigger picture is not very liberating, really, to women. It's not very empowering because it basically leads it all back to these are the choices you have, the options you have, what you've done. It individualizes it, and it reinforces that notion of her victimization has something to do with who she is rather than who he is. So I think that we have to be smart about when we look at that triangle that's in front of you that you've all drawn. We have to understand that the consciousness of being fatalistic, of thinking this is my lot in life, when women come into our groups, whether they're in groups for as victims of sexual assault or victims of battering, there's a certain amount of self-blame, of shame that goes with what's happened to us, and a constant, you know, for those of you who have been through this kind of violence against you, there's, you know that we have this constant thing that goes around in our head, reliving what we could have done, should have done different. Not only that night of when the event happened, but before that and in part of the relationship or whatever, but this constant kind of putting it back on ourselves that somehow we brought this on, somehow we could have stopped it, somehow this, somehow that. So on one hand, we don't want to have people feel like they have no agency and they can't control violence against them at all. But on the other hand, everything's set up to make us believe that this violence that we could have prevented, and it's going to happen to a significant, it's going to happen to one-fourth to half of us. And until we can stop the general violence coming against us, the fact that it didn't happen to me but it happened to this woman is not good enough. You know, we can't just say, well, you know, this woman got strong enough, so she's not going to get herself in this situation or that situation, when he's still out there able to rape another woman or violate another woman. So I think the biggest thing is for us to recognize that there is a consciousness of domination, one of possession, and there's a consciousness of being possessed. And those are not individual failures of either the men or the women. Those are just inherited consciousness that we then have to struggle with. And our, as educators, as communicators with women, we have to always talk with women within a way of talking with women that lets her see the bigger picture, which then frees her from the self-blame and shame that comes with it when we individualize this kind of violence towards her. I'm wondering if there's any questions now that people might have, or comments. You don't have to ask a question.
At this time, there are no calls in the queue. Once again, if you do have a question or comment, press star zero on your touchtone phone. And we do have PAL. Your line is open.
Yes. Hi, Ellen. This is Ken from Rhode Island.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good, good.
It's funny because I was going to say, Rhode Island, you've got to have something to say, for God's sake.
And here we go. I absolutely understand what you're saying, but I just wonder, how do you go about this by letting the victim know the bigger context, but on the same token that you're validating their experience, you know, that it's a violence that had occurred to them,
right.
it becomes almost part of their story, if you will,
mm-hmm. right.
or makeup.
Mm-hmm.
So do people sometimes feel like, well, they're not really listening to me if they're trying to get me to understand the bigger picture?
Right, especially if you don't listen. And like,
yes.
for example, I always had this image of myself coming into my women's group with this 1,000-page book, How to Get Rid of the Patriarchy in Less Than 100 Years, and her coming in with Women Who Love Too Much, you know?
Yeah.
And her book was, If I Can Change This About Me, I'll Be Better. And my book was, We got to get rid of the whole patriarchy before you're going to feel better. And somewhere in between is where we have to be, isn't it? You
yeah.
know?
So there's striking a balance there.
Yes, right. And okay. it's recognizing that, you know, for example, if what you're hearing from the woman is a lot of self-loathing and self-hatred, and it's just saying, talk to me more about that. And, you know, what Paulo Freire says as an educator is you always accept through listening. You listen and you accept, you accept, you accept, but then you push back and on some level reject. So if she's talking about self, I'll give you an example. Women come into women's groups oftentimes, and they'll say, you know, I had it coming. And if you've been trained in the battered women's movement to that you shouldn't, women aren't to blame for their abuse, then you know what you say to her? Well, you know, that's women blaming. And then the next thing you go off with is that you didn't really have it coming, and you start talking to her as if she didn't have it coming, and that this is something that he did, and you kind of just talk over her. And what you really have to do is say, talk to me about how you had it coming. What did you do, you think, that made this happen? And so then she talks, and you ask questions about it. And then you ask her, and you say, I accept that when you called him that name, that hurt him. I accept that when you did this, that was embarrassing to him. What I'm wondering about is when he started hitting you, why that became his reaction to that. And that you had, what is it that you had coming, the beating? I mean, your kids have called you names if you've beaten them. So I'm accepting and rejecting. But you have to listen through all of that, and you have to accept that on some level. If you don't listen to anything she's saying, you just use your ideological position, then you're really taking on that position of the dominator yourself, right?
Yep. Yep.
You all of a sudden become the next person to tell her, you know, don't listen to him. He's telling you you're sick. You're not listening to me. I'm telling you you're sick. You know, kind of that kind of thing. So I agree with you that you really have to take in. And I like this book of Freire's that says Learning to Question. Because he's talking about this whole thing about learning to keep asking questions till a person almost talks themselves into a new explanation of their experience. But people at the bottom of the triangle almost always accept their own guilt for the violence against them. And they need to talk that through so that they can see it. You don't need to tell them, you know, so much as that you need to keep asking the right questions. And then you need to say, this is one thought I'm having about this. This is one way I experience this. And then as you can engage in that conversation, you can have both conversations. Her feelings about that she had it coming, and at the same time, the fact that that's not really what we have coming.
And who was the author of that book, Learning to Question?
It's Paulo Freire. It's F-R-E-I-R-E. And his first book is Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Okay.
Beautiful. And then learning to question is one that's a much more practical thing. I also had some videotapes of him teaching people how to teach. I got to dig them out. They're real old, but they were really good for me. I sat in on these workshops, and we taped these workshops. Mm. And he gave us a lot of examples of I sat in on some groups of batters with him and some women's groups, and he was really good. Like at one time, this guy saying that he loved his wife, and for I said, I believe that. I mean, I accept that you love her. And he said, but what I don't understand is how love, when you love someone, you know, they come in the room and you're excited to see them, and you like touching them, you like smelling them, you like all these kind of things, and then I can't imagine this love and this beating going on. Explain to me how you can beat someone that you love. I need to hear that. And, you know, and then the guy's kind of sitting there thinking, well, I wonder if this is an act of love. And he says, is it love that you experience with her, do you think? Or is it something else? And so that's how he was in the men's group. So he accepted and he let the men talk. He didn't fight with them. So are you happy then, Ken?
I'm very happy. Thank you, Ellen.
Okay.
my next thing is, how do I cue out so we're not on intercom the whole rest of the call?
Okay. All right, get rid of Ken now. Okay. Okay.
At this time, there are no additional questions in the queue.
Okay.
Ellen, you have maybe 6 more minutes?
Yeah, right. I see that now. Okay, so we get the idea about objectification, right? And I think the important thing about objectification is that you need to have social support for making people beatable and rapeable and stalkable. And that's very, very important. If you don't have that social support for it, then you have a bunch of individual men out doing it, and it doesn't work very well. First of all, they get caught more, they get punished more. So you need that social support of it, and that's what we need as the Advocacy Learning Center. We keep needing to see how it is that every time we do our work, we're undermining both the social support and the individual actions at the same time, and that we're supporting both the individual victim as a person who a survivor, as a person who's been through this, but we're also supporting that person as part of a group and linking her to a group consciousness about this that frees her up from the individual pathological notion that if she could just change this or that, everything would be better. And so then the third one that I want to talk about, I don't need to talk so much about violence with impunity because I think most people it speaks for itself, but we have to think of women submitting to their oppression as not something that's an internal process of self-hatred and things like that, as much as it is a forced process. So women submit for a lot of reasons, not just because they have low self-esteem, but they submit for economic reasons. They submit because they need the person if it's a battering situation. They submit to sexual harassment at work because they need their job. They submit to prostitution and pornography because they need the work and they need the income. Women don't get into the porn business or get into prostitution as a career opportunity as much as they get into it as a money-making opportunity. And that usually has a lot to do with not a whole lot of other options, or being brought into it and forced into it through being drugged, through violence and other kind of ways in which she's brought into it. Women coming from other countries are brought into it with promises of something very, very different. And it's hard to know to what extent women would ever have crossed over into that had they known where it would take them. But for most women, it is not like this free choice, like, do I want to be a lawyer, or do I want to be a prostitute or a porn star? And so this notion of women being forced to submit to this kind of authority and dominance, it's all groups that are subjected to this kind of group dominance are also, as a group, conditioned to submit, but not just psychologically, but by the economic system that they live within, by the cultural norms, by the ways that they're taught to have family relations, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, we have to look at the cultural practices that lead to forcing women to submit, as well as the economic practices, as well as the psychological kind of processes that happen for us when we're victimized and when we're preconditioned to be victims or dominated by a group of people. And so this is a struggle that all groups of oppressed people go through. And people use this term internalized oppression, which is part of it, but that, again, individualizes it to, I personally, as an individual, internalize this. And so I'm not saying that internalized oppression isn't a part of the whole thing. There is a lot of, self-hatred that comes with this. There's a lot of hating other people in your group. There's an old story about this man and woman that are walking down the beach, and they're picking up crabs, and her bucket is just, full of crabs, or his bucket is all full of crabs, and her bucket's kind of half empty, and she says, how do you keep the crabs in your bucket? And he says, I just pick up girl crabs, and she says, well, what difference does that make? Well, if one jumps out, the others grab her and pull her back in. And that is the kind of condition of people at the bottom of that hierarchy. Whenever people try to rise up from that position or whatever, there's a lot of horizontal hostility. He's gotten too big for his britches. She thinks that she's a man, blah, 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 blah. And all of this, you see this constant, not only women doing it to each other of hating each other, but a constant portrayal of us as hating each other. All the soap operas and the reality shows and all these things that are on a constant inundating us with this notion that women are catty towards each other, girls shouldn't like each other in school, all that kind of stuff. So it's the images of us that we see, and it's also the reality of it, to a certain extent, of how not only women treat each other, but most groups at the bottom of that triangle. There's a certain amount of group solidarity, and then there's a certain amount of group hostility towards each other. And so I don't want all of I think it's important that we balance off our notion of this third pillar of forced submission, that we see it as both a material thing, again, needing certain jobs, needing to survive, needing housing, needing this, needing that. So there's a material part of this, and then there's a psychological part of it. And so that we're always in our groups and in our relationships with women that we're working with, we're always dealing with the ways in which the cultural practices and the society is forcing to submit, and then he plays off of that. If it's in a battering situation or a stalker or someone who has an ongoing relationship with a woman is able to play off of these kind of preconditions that set women up for submitting to this. Now, for example, a lot of us, I bet you almost every woman on the phone has been in a situation where she either has been sexually abused or almost was sexually abused, and she wasn't able, when she first suspected that this is maybe what was happening to her, she wasn't able to run or get away because she didn't want to hurt his feelings, or she didn't want to make a scene, or she didn't want to do this. And so we're forced to submit even to these situations. I mean, I know so many times when I was in college that I had so many near misses, and not all near misses, but so many near misses where I was in very bad situation, and I thought, this isn't good, but I was too afraid to do things, and I lucked out many times, but we don't always luck out, but we're afraid to yell, we're afraid to scream, we're afraid to say, get this person away from me, I don't know, we're afraid to do those things, and then later on people say, but you went in that room with him, but you got in that car with him, but you did this. And we were already conditioned to do that. And so all of these things, I think, I just want people to kind of think of these four pillars all the time. And there's so much to be said about all this that we can't do now because there's only 2 minutes left. But there's so much about these pillars, that if we can see that working, if we can see the four pillars working, if we can see the triangle, it influences every conversation we have with women. But I want to hearken back to kind of what Ken says. We can't do it in a way that just imposes this political. You can't talk about it the way I am with you. You have to talk about it with women in their own terms and their own ways and natural kind of ways of talking about it, because women will recognize all of this. This is a daily part of their living. All of these things I'm saying are not going to be very new to women, but there's also a certain thing of sometimes when you're deep inside a situation, you can't get the clarity. And to me, that's my role as an advocate, as a person who has a teaching role with women, is that I'm helping women step back and get clarity and get a picture of what's going on that's bigger than the thing that she gets caught up with every day. You know, I think all of us, when we go through times of crisis, I'm kind of going through a little one right now, and I don't have any clarity on it. And as I step back and I, you know, just try to think, talk, I try to talk to the right people so I can get clarity. And I also try to read the right things. I can get a picture of what's going on with me right now, where I'm thinking, oh, I'm all messed up and da-da-da-da. And so I'm just exhorting all of you to be that for the women that you work with. Be that point of clarity. And if you can get some clarity about these four pillars, it's going to help you in every interchange you have, whether it's with a prosecutor, a woman, a man who's been violent towards a woman. They're very, very helpful. Your fallback position. What would Paulo and Andrea say?
And I,
by the way, I can't recommend Andrea Dworkin reading, because it could never get passed by OVW because she swears like a banshee. So,
Ellen, of course, this is absolutely exciting. But I also want to remind that how, although we have a lot of, what you're talking about, we have accepted our, as a group, we think of ourselves as, not on par with the dominant group, etc. But there's also huge resistance that happens.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Women come together as groups, and also from the work that, from what you have talked about, the four pillars, it opens up for us the possibility of collaborating across various groups, not necessarily only domestic violence and sexual assault groups, but various rights-based groups who are working and advocating for other oppressed groups. So it really opens up the possibility of large-scale umbrella resistance to the dominance. And
I didn't get a chance to talk about that because I really wanted to talk about how it is that people begin to resist
them. Next time.
We'll have to do it again. We'll have to do it on doing groups for women that shifts consciousness or something.
Okay,
because that's where resistance then comes from.
And I think we have, I know we're over time, but there's one question, and I don't mean to ignore you if you're there.
We actually have two people in the question queue with a question or a comment.
Okay, so we'll probably go over a little bit if that's okay with everybody. And if you have to leave, please feel free. Can we wrap it up, Ellen?
Thank you very much, everyone. And we'll see Class B in the middle of September. And the belly dancers will be back on stage.
Yeah. And thank you. This is absolutely fascinating. And the whole idea of basing our understanding of advocacy on the four pillars of oppression so that we can get the big picture is amazing. And it is an opportunity for us to change the way we work. I'm totally fascinated, and thank you very much. And I thank all of you for joining us and Ellen on the fourth keynote address. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and my head's buzzing still.
Thanks for getting us together, Shamita.
Thanks. The fifth keynote address is scheduled for October 20th, and when we'll have another very exciting speaker for you. And in the meantime, the Praxis and Manavi staff are available to you. Staff members are available to you for any questions and support. And Beth, I think you have your email address out to all the callers today, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. And Tilly? Tilly is going to come in, and will you tell us some of the exciting events that are coming up, Tilly?
Yes, I just want to Yes, thanks, Shamita. I just want to close. Hi, everyone. This is Tilly. So besides the keynote address in October that Shamita mentioned, next month on August 3rd and 4th, we have the audio conference training for advocates, and the advocate one is on charisma of an organizer. We're excited about that one. And on August 4th, there will be one for managers, which is supporting staff through making the kind of changes you might be making in your organization through the Advocacy Learning Center. In September, we'll have affinity group calls again. And finally, for Class A only, Saswati is asking us to remind you that you should be working on scheduling your site visits. She sent information to you, but if you need help with any of your site visit business, just contact Saswati, and her contact info is on the website. I also want to let you know that the books that Ellen mentioned today in the call are on the website already for your reference if you didn't catch them. And on the password protected page, the password is ConnectA. You will find a resource section, and those books are listed. So I hope to talk to you all soon.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And enjoy the rest of your summer. Thank you.